A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's wrestling with something that I think a lot of people feel but don't always say out loud. He admits he's never been drawn to genealogy. As an Irish-born Jew who made his way to Israel, his life was always oriented forward, toward building a future, not excavating the past. And there's a tension there. Because his Zionist identity means the diaspora stories of his own ancestors, the persecution and the displacement, never felt attractive to dig into. But now he's getting older, and he feels that softening. So the question is, why do different people have such radically different relationships to family history? How does that change over time? And what's actually useful about knowing your roots?
This hits something really deep. And I want to start by saying, the reluctance he's describing, especially for Jews with a strong Zionist orientation, is not random. It's not just personal temperament, it's practically baked into the ideology.
Because Zionism was partly a rejection of the diaspora.
Or, more precisely, it was a rejection of diaspora powerlessness. The early Zionist thinkers, Herzl, Ben-Gurion, they weren't interested in cataloging the shtetl. The shtetl was what you were leaving behind. The whole point was to create a new kind of Jew. Strong, rooted in the land, speaking Hebrew, not Yiddish. Genealogy, by contrast, is inherently backward-looking. It's tracing the very lineage of the diaspora experience. For someone whose identity is built on that rupture, it can feel almost like a betrayal.
Which is wild when you think about it, because Israel is literally built on ancestral claims to land. The whole enterprise is genealogical at its core. This is where our forefathers lived. But for the individual Jewish family, the recent genealogy, the last 300 years in Poland or Morocco or Yemen, that's the part people don't want to touch.
And there's a psychological layer here that researchers have actually studied. There's a concept in family system psychology called the generational cutoff, when families deliberately sever emotional connection to previous generations because the story is too painful. Holocaust survivors often didn't talk about what happened. Their children learned not to ask. The grandchildren are the ones who start digging.
Third generation curiosity. That's a real pattern?
Very well documented. The first generation survives. The second generation absorbs the silence. The third generation, at enough distance that it doesn't feel like immediate threat, starts asking questions. There was a really interesting study out of Emory University. They looked at family narratives and found that children who know their family history, the ups and the downs, show higher resilience and lower anxiety. The key is knowing the full arc, not just the heroic version.
The timing of when someone gets curious isn't random. It's partly developmental, partly historical distance.
Let's be honest about this. When you're 25, your grandparents are often still alive. You can ask them things, but you don't, because you're 25 and you're busy building your own life. By the time you're 45 or 50, they're gone, and suddenly the questions feel urgent. The softening Daniel described? That's the mortality clock ticking. It's not subtle.
I had a friend who described genealogy as the hobby you take up when you realize you're next in line to die.
That's grim, and also accurate.
Here's what I want to push on. You mentioned resilience research. I've seen those studies too. Kids who know their family narrative cope better. But that's the instrumental case for genealogy. Know your roots. Your kids will be healthier. That feels like we're turning ancestry into a wellness supplement. Take two great-grandparents and call me in the morning.
I don't think it's that reductive. The mechanism isn't knowing names and dates makes you resilient. It's that knowing the narrative, the real one, including the failures and the migrations and the people who lost everything and rebuilt, gives you a template for your own struggles. You realize you come from a line of survivors. That's not a vitamin. That's an identity.
Okay, that's fair. But let's talk about the other side, the people who genuinely don't care, and not because of ideological resistance or trauma. Some people just find it boring. And I think there's something honest about that.
And the genealogy industry doesn't want to admit this, but a significant chunk of people who take DNA tests look at the ethnicity estimate once, say, 12% Scandinavian, and never log in again.
The Ancestry.com. So anyway, effect.
And there's research on this, too. A study published by sociologists at the University of Bristol looked at people who engaged with family history and found that interest tends to cluster around life transitions, retirement, the birth of a child, the death of a parent. It's rarely a stable, lifelong passion. It flares up at moments when identity is in flux.
The I'm not interested person might just not have hit their transition moment yet, or they might never hit it, and that's fine.
It is fine. But I do think there's a difference between not caring and actively avoiding. And for a lot of Jews, especially those whose families went through the Holocaust or expulsion from Arab countries, it's not indifference. It's a protective stance. You don't want to open a door to a room full of ghosts.
The ghost room. That's exactly it. Daniel mentioned he felt out of place in Ireland, so his family story is already one of displacement. He lived it personally. He didn't need to dig through archives to understand what it feels like to not belong. And he built a life in Israel, which is the resolution of that story. So going backward to find more displacement, I can see why that wouldn't appeal.
Yet here he is, softening. Which makes me wonder, is it softening toward genealogy specifically, or softening toward the people themselves? Because those are different things. There's a distinction between genealogical research, which is records and dates and ship manifests, and what some scholars call family history, which is the stories. You can want to know who your great-grandfather was as a person, what he believed, what he sounded like when he laughed, without caring at all about his birth certificate. And I think the stories are what pull people in eventually, not the data.
The data is actually kind of boring. I mean, I love data, you love data. But a census record from 1901 is just names and occupations. It's the thinnest possible slice of a life.
Yet people get addicted to it. There's something about the hunt. It's like a detective puzzle where all the suspects are dead and none of them committed a crime.
Covering the cold cases.
But here's what I actually find fascinating. The different cultural attitudes toward genealogy. Because it's not universal at all. In China, ancestor veneration is thousands of years old. Knowing your lineage isn't a hobby. It's a moral obligation. In many West African cultures, griots memorize centuries of family history and recite it at ceremonies. And then you have modern America, where genealogy is basically a consumer product. Spit in a tube, get a pie chart, maybe discover you're related to a minor 18th century nobleman.
The gamification of ancestry. You don't find your roots, you unlock them. Achievement earned, you're 1/32nd Welsh.
Family secrets come out. Non-paternity events. The industry sells you a story about discovering yourself, but sometimes what you actually discover is that your grandfather wasn't your grandfather.
Which is the kind of truth that doesn't necessarily make anyone more resilient.
No, it can be devastating. And this is where I think the Jewish relationship to genealogy is actually quite distinctive. For a lot of Jews, the records don't exist. They were burned. They were bombed. The people who could have told the stories were murdered. So genealogy isn't just a matter of curiosity plus free time. It's an act of reconstruction against deliberate erasure.
Yad Vashem's whole project of collecting names. That's genealogical work framed as memorial. It's not, find your roots, it's prove this person existed.
That reframes the entire enterprise. When records were systematically destroyed, finding a single document, a passenger list, a displaced person's camp registration, is not just satisfying curiosity. It's an act of resistance against the attempt to wipe out a people.
For someone like Daniel, whose ancestors presumably went through some version of that, the resistance framing might actually be more compelling than the hobbyist framing. You're not poking around in old records for fun. You're saying, they tried to erase this line, and I'm going to prove it continued.
That's a powerful reframe, and I think it connects to the Zionist narrative in a way that might not be obvious at first. Because the early Zionists wanted to break with the diaspora, yes. But the modern Israeli relationship to the Holocaust is actually deeply genealogical. The March of the Living, the trips to Poland, the emphasis on never forget, that's all about maintaining a living connection to the people who were destroyed.
The grandchildren going back to the villages. That's the third generation curiosity you mentioned.
And Israel as a state has invested massively in genealogical infrastructure. the Central Archives for the History of the Jewish People, the Douglas Goldman Genealogy Center at Beit Hatfutzot, Yad Vashem's database of Shoah victims' names, these are all state-supported projects. So the idea that genealogy is somehow anti-Zionist or diaspora-obsessed doesn't hold up. The state itself does genealogy.
The state does it at the collective level. The Jewish people. Not, here's what your specific great-uncle Moishe did in Vilna in 1923. And I think for some people, the collective story is enough. They don't need the individual details.
For others, the collective story only becomes real through the individual details. You can know intellectually that Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492. It's different to know that your specific ancestor walked across the Pyrenees and ended up in Salonika.
That's the difference between history and memory.
History is what happened. Memory is what happened to us.
Let me ask you something. You've done some of this, right? Family history research?
My family on one side goes back to Storrs, Connecticut for generations, which is not very exotic, but there are stories. And on the other side, there are gaps. Eastern European Jewish gaps. Places where the trail just stops. And I found that the gaps themselves tell you something. The absence is itself a piece of information.
The negative space. You learn what was destroyed by what you can't find.
And that's something the standard genealogy advice doesn't really prepare you for. The genealogy forums are full of people celebrating breakthroughs. I found the ship manifest. I traced the line back to 1683. But for a lot of people, the experience is more like, I searched for 3 years and found nothing, and that nothing is a monument to a catastrophe.
Which brings us back to the question of usefulness. What's actually useful about knowing your roots? If the process is painful, if the records are destroyed, if it surfaces family secrets, why do it?
I think there are different answers for different people. For some, it's medical. Knowing your family health history is useful. It can inform screening decisions, lifestyle choices. Ashkenazi Jews have elevated risk for certain genetic conditions, Tay-Sachs being the most famous, but also BRCA mutations. That's not sentimental. That's actionable.
There's a hard-nosed practical case.
There's the identity piece. And this gets complicated, but I think it's real. Knowing where you come from can anchor you in a way that's hard to articulate. You understand why your family has certain traditions, certain foods, certain ways of being in the world. It doesn't determine who you are, but it contextualizes it.
That's why we do that moment.
And then there's a third thing which is harder to capture, what I'd call narrative inheritance. You inherit not just genes and traditions, but stories. And those stories shape your sense of what's possible. If you know that your great-grandmother crossed an ocean alone at 19, not speaking the language, and built a life, that's a story you carry. It changes your sense of your own capacities.
That only works if the stories are actually transmitted. And in a lot of families, they're not. The great-grandmother who crossed the ocean alone? Maybe nobody ever talked about her. Maybe she was ashamed of how hard it was. Maybe her children wanted to be fully assimilated and didn't want to hear about the old country.
That's the generational cutoff again. And that's where genealogical research can actually heal something. Not by forcing people to engage with pain they're not ready for, but by making it available when they are ready.
The archive waits.
The archive waits. And I think that's one of the kindest things about genealogical work. The records don't pressure you. They just sit there. When you're ready, they're there.
You know, there's something else I want to bring in here. We've been talking mostly about Jewish genealogy, but the prompt is broader than that. It's about how different people have different attitudes. And I think one of the biggest divides is between people who come from immigrant families and people who don't.
Oh, that's huge. If your family has been in the same county for 300 years, genealogy feels different. It's almost like local history at that point. You can visit the graveyard where 6 generations are buried. The records are in English, in the same courthouse they've always been in. It's accessible in a way that immigrant genealogy just isn't.
Versus the immigrant experience, where someone got on a boat and changed their name, or had it changed for them at Ellis Island, and the paper trail crosses languages and borders and empires that don't exist anymore.
The name changes are a killer. I've seen cases where a family left as Klein, arrived as Small, and then the grandchildren are looking for Klein and can't find Small, or vice versa. The genealogy becomes a translation project as much as a research project.
Which is why DNA testing has been such a game changer for immigrant families. The paper trail may be broken, but the genetic trail isn't.
With huge caveats. The DNA databases are heavily skewed toward people of European descent. If your family is from, say, Nigeria or China or Peru, the reference populations are much thinner. You might get a result that says West African broadly, which you already knew. The precision isn't there.
The technology that's supposed to democratize genealogy actually reproduces some of the same biases.
And there's a privacy dimension, too. When you upload your DNA to a commercial database, you're not just sharing your own genetic information. You're sharing information about everyone you're related to. Your siblings, your parents, your children, your cousins, they didn't consent to that.
That's the Golden State Killer problem. The detective work that caught that serial killer used a genealogy database. It was brilliant police work. It also meant that people who just wanted to know if they were part Irish accidentally helped identify a murderer in their family tree.
The legal framework around this is still catching up. In the US, there's no comprehensive federal law governing genetic privacy. The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GIN, prevents health insurers and employers from discriminating based on genetic information, but it doesn't cover life insurance, disability insurance, or long-term care insurance. And it doesn't restrict what the testing companies can do with your data.
The cheerful Ancestry.com commercial with the person discovering they're related to a medieval king. There's a whole shadow side to that.
And I think the people who are skeptical of genealogy, who find it boring or off-putting, sometimes they're picking up on something real. The industry presents it as this wholesome, uplifting journey of self-discovery. But it's a multi-billion dollar business that monetizes your biological data. And the emotional journey it promises doesn't always deliver.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper with a dark back end.
That's one way to put it. But I don't want to be too cynical, because for a lot of people, it is meaningful. I've talked to people who found siblings they didn't know they had, people who connected with relatives across continents, Holocaust survivors who found out that a branch of their family survived that they thought was completely wiped out.
Those reunions, I've seen videos, they're devastating in the best way.
Those moments wouldn't happen without the infrastructure, without the databases, without the digitization of records. So it's not that the industry is evil. It's that the industry doesn't always acknowledge the complexity of what it's offering.
Let's talk about the digitization piece, because that's actually a huge shift. My understanding is that a massive amount of genealogical records have come online in just the last 15 years.
It's been a revolution. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, have been microfilming records since the 1930s. They have the largest genealogical collection in the world, stored in a vault carved into a mountain in Utah. And in the last couple of decades, they've digitized billions of those records and made them searchable through FamilySearch.org.
The Mormon interest in genealogy is theological, right? Baptism of the dead?
They believe that families can be sealed together for eternity, and that requires identifying ancestors and performing proxy baptisms on their behalf. It's controversial. Jewish groups have objected to Holocaust victims being posthumously baptized, but the practical result is that the Mormons have built and maintained an extraordinary archival infrastructure that everyone benefits from.
The world's best genealogy resource exists because of a specific religious doctrine. That's such a strange and interesting fact.
It gets stranger. The Granite Mountain Vault in Utah, it's called the Granite Mountain Records Vault, is built to withstand a nuclear blast. It has massive blast doors. The temperature and humidity are controlled to preserve film and paper for centuries. It's basically a doomsday bunker for family history.
The Mormon apocalypse prep meets ancestor worship. That's incredible.
It's not just Mormon records. They've done preservation work in countries all over the world, including places where records were deteriorating in poor storage conditions. In some cases, the only surviving copy of a 19th century parish register is the microfilm the Mormons made in the 1970s, because the original was destroyed in a war or a natural disaster.
There's an accidental preservation function. The theological mission created a secular public good.
And that's a pattern in genealogy more broadly. The motivations are mixed. Some people are doing it for religious reasons, some for identity reasons, some for medical reasons, some just because they like puzzles. The infrastructure that emerges serves all of them.
If someone like Daniel, who's been resistant to this, is starting to soften, what would you actually recommend? Not in a here's your 10-step genealogy plan way, but more conceptually. What's a useful way in?
I think the first thing is to not start with the records at all. Start with the living people. If you have older relatives, talk to them. Record the conversations. Ask questions that aren't about dates and places. Ask about what they remember, what they heard, what they were told not to talk about.
The oral history first.
Because the oral history is what gives the records meaning. A ship manifest is just a list of names. But if your grandmother told you that her mother cried the entire voyage because she knew she'd never see her own parents again, suddenly that list of names is a document of grief.
The oral history is perishable. Once someone dies, their memories die with them. The records will wait.
The second thing I'd say is, be prepared for what you find. Genealogy isn't always uplifting. You might find poverty, crime, mental illness, abandonment. You might find the people you admire did things you can't reconcile. You might find that the family story you grew up with isn't true.
The myth-busting side.
For some people, that's fascinating. For others, it's destabilizing. Neither reaction is wrong. But I think it's worth asking yourself, before you start digging, am I ready to have my family story complicated?
That's such a good question. Because the family story serves a function. It's not just information. It's a kind of mythology that tells you who you are and where you fit. And if you pull on a thread and the whole thing unravels, what do you replace it with?
Ideally, you replace a simplified mythology with a more complex and true story. But that's work. It's emotional work. And not everyone wants to do that work, especially if their life is already full and meaningful without it.
Which brings us back to the original question, what's useful about knowing your roots? And I think one answer is, it's useful precisely to the extent that you're ready to have your story complicated. If you're not ready, it's probably not useful. It might even be harmful.
I'd add one more thing about usefulness. There's a humility that comes from genealogical work. When you trace your line back, you realize how many people had to survive, how many contingencies had to line up for you to exist. It's a corrective to the idea that you're self-made. You're not. You're the product of thousands of decisions and accidents and migrations and marriages and near misses stretching back centuries.
The genealogical case against individualism.
You didn't build that. You didn't build any of it. You inherited a story that was already in motion long before you were born, and I think that's a healthy thing to sit with.
Even if the story is painful.
Especially if the story is painful. Because the pain is part of what was survived. If your ancestors went through something terrible and you're here, that means they made it through. That's not a story of victimhood. That's a story of endurance.
For someone with a Zionist identity, that reframe might actually resonate. The diaspora wasn't just a long defeat. It was a long survival. The fact that the Jewish people still exist after everything is itself a kind of victory.
Genealogy makes that survival personal. It's not just the Jewish people survived. It's this specific family, my family, survived. That's a different feeling.
You know, we've been talking for a while, and I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier. The distinction between history and memory. Because I think that's really the heart of this. Some people are content with history. They know the broad strokes. The Jews were expelled from Spain. Their ancestors came from somewhere in Eastern Europe. That's enough. Other people need memory. They need the specific face, the specific name, the specific street.
Neither is morally superior. It's not a failure to be satisfied with history. But I do think that memory does something that history can't. History tells you what happened. Memory tells you that what happened matters.
Memory is fragile in a way that history isn't. History is written down. Memory lives in people, and people die.
Which is why the oral history piece is so urgent. There's a window.
If you're listening to this and you're on the fence, you're not sure if you care about genealogy, you're not sure if you want to open that door, maybe the thing to do is just have one conversation. Ask one older relative one question. Not as a research project, just as a human thing.
Even if you never listen to it again, your kids might, your grandkids might. You're not just gathering information for yourself, you're creating an archive for people who don't exist yet.
The archive waits, but someone has to build it.
Someone has to build it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, a French astronomer visiting the Seychelles mistook an unusually intense red aurora for a massive naval battle on the horizon and dispatched an urgent warning ship, which sailed for 2 days before the crew realized there was no fire, no fleet, and no war. The red color came from high-altitude oxygen interacting with a solar storm, a phenomenon that wouldn't be scientifically explained for another 2 centuries.
2 days at sea chasing a skyfire. That's commitment to being wrong.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com. We're produced by Hilbert Flumingtop, and we'll be back with a new episode soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.